Great Lives is a download from Radio 4. We hope you enjoy what you're about to hear. In anybody's book, he's one of the giants of modern American literature. The New York Times once called him the most important new writer since Shakespeare. And to my guest today, he's been a lifetime's guiding star.
Writing at its best is a lonely life. Organizations for writers palliate the writer's loneliness, but I doubt if they improve his writing. He grows in public stature as he sheds his loneliness, and often his work deteriorates. For he does his work alone, and if he is a good enough writer, he must face eternity, or the lack of it, each day.
Ernest Miller Hemingway, speaking in 1954, receiving the Nobel Prize for Literature, a man who loved fishing, shooting, boxing and bullfighting. He wrote, for instance, A Farewell to Arms, For Whom the Bell Tolls, The Old Man and the Sea. And it was while reading these books for his A-levels that the man with me now first came across Hemingway, and later went on to write, "I felt I'd grown up a little. I lost my literary virginity. Books would never be quite the same again."
I suppose it was my own kind of discovery in the same way that I discovered Elvis Presley. My parents hated that. You know, I always thought when Elvis Presley came on and sang Heartbreak Hotel, they thought the wireless set had broken. "Is the set broken, old boy?" my father would say. And I said, "No, just the way he sings." In the same way, Hemingway was my discovery. And a lot of people said, this is not really the way literature should be, apart from Mr. Jones, who was the teacher at Shrewsbury at the time, who did feel that was what we should study.
So that was where it was, Shrewsbury. Tell me, what was the work?
The first work was For Whom the Bell Tolls.
Yes.
Which is a tricky work. I have trouble with it now because there's a lot of thou and thee. The book I like more of the two was Farewell to Arms. And I thought the opening paragraph of Farewell to Arms, for me, sort of summed up what Hemingway's language was doing for me. And it's a curious first paragraph. "In the late summer of that year, we lived in a house in a village that looked across the river and the plain to the mountains. In the bed of the river, there were pebbles and boulders, dry and white in the sun, and the water was clear and swiftly moving and blue in the channels. Troops went by the house and down the road, and the dust they raised powdered the leaves of the trees. The trunks of the trees, too, were dusty, and the leaves fell early that year, and we saw the troops marching along the road, and the dust rising, and leaves, stirred by the breeze, falling, and the soldiers marching, and afterwards the road bare and white, except for the leaves."
I had thought that it would be the life, rather than the literary style that first drew you to Hemingway, but it's the writing, is it?
It was the writing, first of all.
Yeah.
Absolutely. It was a clear, fresh voice.
Not too many adjectives. Mm. Really just a series of facts, bang, bang, bang. And yet, as the facts pepper us, the picture builds in the mind. It was a new kind of writing.
I think it was, yes. I think the way what he said, write about what you really feel, not what you're supposed to feel. That appealed to me as a schoolboy who was also trying to find something that was new and different was my own. He was a modern writer. Later, of course, I saw him also as a great traveller and a great adventurer and a great character, you know, someone who created a brand, whether you like it or not. You know, the word Hemingway meant something. So he was larger than life. And then I began to feel, well, he's actually rather a comic figure. Here's this man trying to prance across the world stage, being bigger and tougher and stronger and more powerful and be able to catch more fish and shoot more ducks than anybody else. And that, I thought, well, this is a slightly ridiculous pose. But when I started to research, I suddenly found there was a great deal more to him and much more sort of, he was much more vulnerable than the image that others gave of him, being a misogynist or a bully or a womanizer or whatever. He was none of those.
Here now is a writer who's written about Hemingway and his women, our expert witness, Naomi Wood, who's written a fictional story of the wives of Ernest Hemingway called Mrs. Hemingway, and also teaches creative writing at Goldsmiths University, London. Naomi, four wives, innumerable affairs, cocktails without number. Was he just sociable?
Yes, absolutely. Sociable is putting it very lightly. He was
certainly
sociable.
Insatiable.
He was a party animal. If you drank how much he drank in some of the novels, I think you'd be dead by, you know, breakfast.
The interesting thing about it all is that he sort of sees himself as a dramatic figure in his life. I mean, he wasn't the first to actually pioneer this modern kind of writing. Mm, I mean, Gertrude Stein, for instance, was writing like that before then, and there were others as well. Mm. But he somehow took the credit, or just he popularised it, because I think he dramatised everything. So his life was big. He was charismatic. People were drawn to him. You know, Gertrude Stein, Marlene Dietrich, all sorts of people were drawn to this man, and he enjoyed that.
Nor should we give the impression that it was only a jolly party-going life. There's a huge amount of despair and loneliness, which we'll come to, and maybe start with his childhood. Just in a nutshell, Naomi, tell us a bit about his childhood.
He was born in July 1899 to Grace and Ed Hemingway. They were a well-to-do couple. His father was a physician. His mother was obsessed with music and had actually had a debut as an opera singer at Madison Square Gardens, and then sort of selflessly, as she put it, gave up her life to have six children. It was an outdoors life. He spent all of his summers in North Michigan, up in the lakes. And
with his dad.
With his dad, and his dad taught him how to shoot, how to fish. And it was really all that material that came into many of his short stories. I think it was a happy childhood, if slightly marred by this tension which comes out later with his mother. He thought she was very domineering, very difficult. He thought that she treated his father very badly.
You visited the family home.
Yeah, a lot of the family homes. But certainly, I think we've both been to the Finca here in Cuba. What interests me then was Hemingway as a traveller. The great American writer spent only 11 years of his professional life in America. The rest of the time, he was in Cuba, or he was in Spain, or he was in France, and he was a very good traveller. He stayed in the places. He wasn't just a tourist. He went and lived there, and he sort of lived the life.
Where do you think his desire to be a writer came from?
For me, I think it came out of his stint at the Kansas City Star when he was a cub reporter. And he opened the style book, and it just gave these very, very clear instructions. Use vigorous English. Use declarative sentences. Use short sentences. Be positive, not negative. And I think suddenly that opened up for him an idea, a kind of approach or a policy of how to approach writing fiction. And what he wanted to do, in my mind, is he wanted high-minded reviewers to read it, as well as high school kids. You didn't need a dictionary to read Hemingway. That was his most important philosophy.
No $10 words.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah.
Was it also tied into his love of action and the active life? I mean, the fact that he was 17 years old, or 18, was it, when he signed up for the First World War? Mm. You know, went all the way from comfortable Chicago to the Austro-Italian front.
And I think that's what makes Hemingway really unique as a writer, because Hemingway was a man of action as well as words.
Did you realise at an early age, Michael, that you wanted a life of action, travel and adventure?
No, not really. I mean, I when I was young, I wanted to be an explorer, and I thought that would be the thing to do.
But I've
never been explored. Mm. So I then sort of fell more into acting, and I thought that was my sort of own kind of adventure. The seeds of what I'd read in Hemingway, and also what I read in sort of the stories that I was brought up with, was definitely travel. And I suppose travel eventually meant adventure, as it did to Hemingway.
We left the young Hemingway a few minutes ago, just going into the First World War. Did he see action in the First World War?
He was an ambulance driver for the Red Cross. He goes to the front and is very, very badly wounded at Fasalta, and manages to carry, even though he's so badly wounded, he has 227 pieces of shrapnel in his leg, manages to carry an Italian soldier to safety, for which he's awarded the Silver Cross.
So he really was brave.
Yes, but he says in a short story later that he wasn't brave, he was instinctive. He talks about this in a short story called In Another Country.
He fell in love for the first time during the First World War as well.
Yes, with his nurse, Agnes Kurovsky, I think.
Correct.
She was called. With Agnes, clearly he was very romantic towards her. It wasn't really a kind of conquest or anything like that. He came rather soppy over her, didn't he?
I don't think she was in love with him seriously back. She
But he thought so, didn't he? Because he really idealised this relationship and
yeah.
and wanted to bring her home with him. And it was quite a sort of sad end to their little romance, wasn't it?
He wanted to marry her. I think it was a hugely important relationship. Mm. I think critics have loved to talk about Agnes as because she was the one who rejected him first. And maybe this is a kind of code by which we can explain his subsequent behaviour with other women. I think, you know, she rejected him. He mourned. He was grief-stricken, really, and even more so because he had to go back to his family home in Chicago.
Would you say that the next affair, and that ended in marriage, was on the rebound?
No, I don't think so. He had been separated from Agnes for 2 years, so and he was ready at 20 to meet a lovely young woman who emerged in the form of Hadley Richardson, who was 8 years his senior. They met in Chicago and were married the next year, and they moved very quickly to Paris.
Also, the life they led then was very simple. They lived in a little apartment. It was always cold. They had to get coal from the guy selling them out on the street and everything. They were very, very poor.
Why had he gone to Paris?
Exchange rate. Something as boringly economic. It was
absolutely true.
It was the centre of literary happenings. It was the Anglo-American experiment of modernism. Mm. And suddenly they realised how cheaply they could live on the dollars they'd saved.
It strikes me that he's become a figure in literary circles before he's actually become a great and recognised writer. There seems to be a buzz about the man himself. He's obviously a great networker.
I think that's true, and I think that's true throughout his life. He was published because people liked the work, but also they felt there was something quite... there's a crackle of something new and different about the man himself.
Ezra Pound said, I'm teaching him how to write, and he is teaching me how to box.
Yes, great phrase. Yeah. But, Michael, what attracts you to him? I yield to no one, honestly, in my admiration of your work. I thrill to have been myself once called a poor man's Michael Palin, less thrillingly sub-Michael Palin.
We'll discuss this later.
You're not a Hemingway figure. You're not macho in that way. You're not a hunter or a fighter, a drinker, a bruiser, a womaniser. You've been happily married to Helen for, is it 47 or 48 years? Is this your alter ego?
Possibly. I think it's... what attracts me to him, how he thought about the life, how he thought about his writing, the doubts that he expressed about his life. And that interested me, actually, the weaknesses in the man, the vulnerability in the man. And he also, what I admire about him was he was absolutely committed to writing and the craft of writing. He wrote almost every single day, even though he'd had 17 bottles the night before or whatever, and 10 daiquiris at lunchtime. He still always wrote.
Wonder what he'd have made of Monty Python. You've got a Monty Python reunion tour coming up this summer. Can you imagine him in your audience? Would it be laughing? Would it be lost on him?
I think he'd be up there on stage. I don't think he'd want to be in the audience. No. I think he'd volunteer to be one of the Mounties chorus. And then the next thing I know, he'd be singing Lumberjack song. And he'd be perfect for that. A cut down tree, eat my lunch.
You're listening to Great Lives with me, Matthew Paris, where my guest Michael Palin is championing Ernest Hemingway. Our expert is Naomi Wood. A moment ago we left Hemingway living in Paris. He'd had a few short stories published, but it's in 1925 that he begins to meet with real literary success. What were critics saying about his work then, Naomi?
There was a small collection of short stories called In Our Time, which is now worth a fabulous amount. If anyone's got a copy, it's quite a little nest egg at £120,000 per copy. It's a 170 print run. And they praised the toughness. They praised the minimal amount of words it took to reach a maximum effect. It was almost as if he burst onto the stage without a real apprenticeship. It was followed by The Torrents of Spring, which is a strange novel, and The Sun Also Rises, which is really his breakout book in 1926. It talked about expatriate life in Paris and the cafes.
And on the personal front, although the literary side is going well, more turmoil. He has an affair, well, marries Pauline Pfeiffer.
Yes, so he's married to Hadley, and there's been one notable incident in their marriage, which many people feel is the kind of breakdown in trust, where she loses a suitcase which is full of his work. It's full of his...
That would cause me a breakdown.
Well, I think it would cause me one as well. His short stories and the beginning of a novel. She leaves it on a train and it's stolen. And she says in a biography of her life, you know, I just wish he'd been... angry. Instead, he was quietly disappointed, which is even worse. Anyways, it was in this kind of shaky situation that Pauline Pfeiffer, who was rather urbane, sort of wisecracking flapper figure, she worked at Vogue, came onto the scene in Paris. Detractors say she was shopping for her husband. Other people say she was having a good old time getting through the cocktails. But she and Hemingway began to have an affair. Eventually, he plumps for Pauline and they marry a year later and spend 13 years with her. And they move to America, settle in Key West, southernmost city in the whole of the States. And he discovers deep sea fishing and life in the Caribbean. It doesn't suit her so much.
And then the father committed suicide quite early on in the marriage, I think.
Yeah, he was in the middle of writing A Farewell to Arms.
Yes.
It was a shattering when his father committed suicide in 1928.
And at this stage, for Ernest Hemingway, more problems because the critics were beginning to go off him.
He was really the critics' golden boy in the 1920s, and then he very quickly became their whipping boy. But it was more his exploits off the page, which I think got their goat. He wrote all these dispatches for Esquire. You know, this is how to skin a lion, and this is how to catch your
monster
fish.
Critics wouldn't like that because they're a rather weedy bunch, aren't they?
Well, he called them lice that live in literature.
But also, he was becoming a bit of a caricature of himself, really. Yeah. He was asking for it in a way.
Yes. And then off to the Civil War, speaking of caricatures of themselves, he went off to the Spanish Civil War.
He always wanted to be where the action was. Yes. I mean, he was courageous. He was foolhardy, but he was quite courageous. Didn't have to go to the war.
No.
But he went off to a very brutal war and was there on the front line. He made this documentary, didn't he, about for the Republican side, in which he did the commentary in his rather strange, slightly weedy voice he had, which was a bit disappointing.
And an affair with another woman at the same time.
Yes, Martha Gellhorn. The carousel turns once more. It's in Madrid that his affair with Martha Gellhorn, the novelist and war correspondent, really flourishes.
Martha was a different kind of woman from the other two, wasn't she? She was very independent. She wanted to be a writer herself. She didn't want to be anchored to anybody else. Didn't particularly want to be a mum or a wife.
I think he'd met his match in meeting Martha Gellhorn.
Yeah.
A journalist described them as a pairing of flint and steel.
she got better reviews than he did, you know, and this must have irked him a lot.
And then off to Cuba.
Yes, they're at the Spanish Civil War until 1939, and he's still actually married to Pauline Pfeiffer, who...
struggling to keep up.
Yeah, exactly. Too many women, too many wives. In 1939, Martha joins him, and they live at the Ambo Mundo Hotel in Havana, and she can't bear how unhygienic he is, starts calling him the pig, whether that's, flattery. I don't know if that's a joking nickname
or
not.
It doesn't sound like a term of endearment.
And she goes off to find them a house to live in, so he moves in there.
People by now had started to call him, or some people had started to call him a bit of a fraud. Is there any truth in that? Does any of that mud stick, do you think, Michael?
Well, I don't know. Any account of the war and his acts of heroism will be countered by someone else who was there at the time and said, no, Hemingway wasn't actually there. And you just don't know whether this is just a journalist getting the facts slightly wrong. Not particularly, because I'm not looking at him as an ideal. I'm looking at him as sort of a mixture of things. And that would go as part of the weakness. He's this desire to sort of thump his own chest and say, look, I've done all this. He's actually stacking up problems for later on. This is all going to come back rather and haunt him in a way.
Did he see a lot of action in the Second World War?
Yes, he did. In fact, too much. He was arraigned for breaking the Geneva Convention because he got involved in too much action. And took a perverse pleasure in it. He said he had this kind of, he felt the aesthetic pride of clean killing, which is a really strange phrase. And then very quickly, as the winter descended, he thought, right, I want to be back in Cuba in the sunshine with the gin and coconuts.
And he was, eventually, and with wife number four, I think. Am I getting
No, you're right. He spends 6 weeks in London, actually, before he goes to France in 1944, and he meets a rather lovely reporter called Mary Welsh, who worked for Time magazine and had actually spent the whole war in London, and decides that, seen as Martha is, by all accounts, not interested anymore in him, he better find, you know, the next Mrs. Hemingway. He shacks up with Mary. Eventually, they marry in Cuba in 46.
You say, you know, he had to find the next Mrs. Hemingway. I mean, why did he need to, do you think?
That's the part of his personality that interests me so much. And I think it comes back to what you were saying about why you're fascinated with Hemingway. It's not for the macho side of him. And for me, the women explain a part of his personality that is not well illuminated, this longing for tenderness, this longing for companionship, which I think just under the tough, taciturn layer of his prose, you can feel a bruise of yearning, of tenderness. And I think he found writing so difficult, and I think the women were able to kind of palliate that sense of wretchedness and loneliness.
Finally came the Nobel Prize, which I guess did mean a lot to him.
Yes, I think he was secretly very chuffed to receive that, because he didn't receive any prizes for Whom the Bell Tolls. You know, he said, I finally won that Swedish thing, which he was very chuffed. And you know, notably, he was always complaining about how much tax he had to pay on his income, and he didn't have to pay any tax on that prize. So he was thrilled.
Yeah.
And his health was declining even as his literary fame was established. His wife then set up a holiday in Africa. Well, holiday is perhaps the wrong word. What happened, Michael?
A man who's always accident prone met the kind of ultimate nemesis, which was two plane crashes, one after the other. And in the Hemingway adventure, I've just got a little section which I describe what happened, because it's almost unbelievable. By the time the SS Murchison had brought the party safely to Butiaba, which was the nearest town, this is Uganda, word had gone out via the wire services of the world that one of the greatest living authors, the Old Man on the Sea, had just won a Pulitzer Prize, was missing, believed dead, in the heart of Africa. Bounty hunters were already searching the area, and the lucky one, a Captain Reginald Cartwright, had tracked them down to Butiaba. He had a de Havilland Rapide refuelled and ready to whisk them out of this hellhole and back to Entebbe. Hemingway was not so keen, felt he'd rather proceed by road, but he was overruled, and the three of them, Ernest, Mary, his wife, and Roy Marsh, the pilot of the plane that already crashed, squeezed into the Rapide. Hemingway described for Look magazine readers what happened next. One third of the way down the alleged airstrip, I was convinced that we should not be airborne successfully. However, we continued at the maximum rate of progress of the aircraft, which was leaping from crag to crag in the manner of the wild goat. Suddenly this object became violently airborne through no fault of its own. This condition existed only for a matter of seconds, after which the aircraft became violently de-airborne, and there was the usual sound, with which we were all by now familiar, of rending metal. Hemingway's survival of two consecutive air crashes was news across the world, and generally the cause of much rejoicing, but it had come at considerable cost. Writing to Harvey Bright 10 days later, Hemingway assessed the damage. I ruptured the kidneys, or maybe only one. The liver, the spleen, whoever she is, had the brain fluid ooze out to soak the pillow every night, burnt the top off the scalp, also had to take two breathes in the fire, which is something that never really helped anybody, except, of course, Joan of Arc. He didn't mention the sprained arm and leg, and the crushed vertebrae, and the paralysed sphincter, and the temporary loss of hearing and eyesight. So these were two massive... Yeah. Really, for someone who was used to sort of being battered, there was a real concentration of injuries. And I think from that, he never really recovered from that. Here's a scoop, though, because I have with me, because we went, I think the only film crew ever to go to Uganda and talk to the people who witnessed the air crash. And a gentleman there has the wreckage of Hemingway's plane up in his attic.
Oh, fantastic.
And he gave me, he said, here you are.
Oh, look at that.
Michael, you must take home some wreckage to remember us by.
It's a bit of mild steel with what looked like bullet holes in it, completely shot to pieces.
But there it is. I've never really shown this to anybody, and it's a pity it's on radio, but there they are.
Hemingway recuperated from the two plane crashes by drinking a bottle of champagne while the cerebral fluid was leaking out onto his pillow. So it didn't have a great way of convalescence. And the plane crashes, for me, are what signals the real point of no return for Hemingway's health.
How many years after that finally took his own life?
I think it was about 7 years.
Yes.
A miserable sort of end.
I mean, it was horrible. And I think reason had really fled him. He was finding it increasingly difficult to write or have any control over his writing.
And the electroshock therapy?
By 1960, he was in a very bad way. After a suicide attempt, Mary said, you've got to go to the Mayo Clinic in Minnesota. He was there for a few months, and it was under the guise of high blood pressure, but it was actually to receive some psychotherapy in terms of electroshock therapy, not talk therapy. And he called it frying the bacon.
I thought it was interesting that during this period, he did, in front of her, reach for his gun and try to pick it up and point it at himself. She never put the guns away. She never locked the guns away.
She said a man should never be deprived of his own possessions.
I think perhaps she thought that will be the last thing that will kill him, ironically. But when he did take his own life, shot himself in this little porch of the house in Idaho, she was completely in denial and told the world that it was an accident while cleaning his gun. And she maintained this for some time.
Yeah.
Would you say, though, Michael, that given the sort of life that he had led and the reputation that he sustained, perhaps there was something appropriate about the way he fixed it at the end?
I think absolutely. I think the way he'd almost sort of, in a sense, managed his life, presented himself as this man of action, so when it came to the point where he could no longer be a man of action, he could no longer do what he felt life was about, whether it was shooting, hunting, writing, whatever, that was it. He said, right, I'm going to be in control of the situation. Sadly, as Naomi has said, he wasn't really. He was having this electric shock treatment. He was mentally disturbed. He wasn't making sense. There was an unpleasantness about the whole thing. But I was trying to find a bit of Hemingway's writing that might sum up what I feel is interesting about him and why I feel he's a great man. And this is a letter, actually, written when he was only 24 years old, from Hemingway to Bill Horn in Paris. And he just says something quite wise, which I quite like because of what he wrote after that. Anyway, he says to Bill Horn, we can't ever go back to old things or try and get the old kick out of something or find things the way we remembered them. We have them as we remember them, and they're fine and wonderful, and we have to go on and have other things, because the old things are nowhere except in our minds now.
My thanks to Michael Palin and Naomi Wood. Goodbye.